Okay. Yeah, thank you very much for the introduction. So so this talk is from the quantum dynamics program, and I have decided to talk about somehow more specific example of non-equilibrium dynamics in a quantum many-body system, namely about the specific case of Fermi liquid. And there's there's three main reasons for that. And the first reason is that actually in this model, we will be able to arrive at a fairly complete understanding using a blackboard calculation. So it's going to be a very, some very simple examples that you need to look at to understand what's going on. The second reason is that, of course, for someone doing condensed matter physics like me, the Fermi liquid is kind of the probably the single most important model to look at and to understand. And we do understand it very well in equilibrium, and that's, of course, a motivation to study it in non-equilibrium as well. And the third reason is that once we understand something about the specific kind of non-equilibrium dynamics that I want to look at in the Fermi liquid, we will be able to actually see a lot of possible questions that one can ask in other models, and we will be able to understand why some questions are fairly easy to address and understand in this model and much harder in other settings. So now the outline of the talk is this is mainly addressed to people, actually only addressed to people not in condensed matter physics. So this is a brief reminder of what Fermi liquid is. So I mean, fragnets and two dynamics people, for this, for them, this will be just a reminder. Then I will be saying something about what situations you typically look at when we study quantum many-body systems, and that is basically we look at Gibbs states. But one can do it nowadays through experiments that go beyond that, so I'll be saying something about that. Then there, I'll show you a simple calculation, actually just with a harmonic oscillator. And that simple calculation will be the main ingredient that will show us what happens when we do what's called an interaction quench in a Fermi gas. In order to arrive at a complete picture, we will need to remember what Boltzmann taught us about kinetic theories. And putting everything together, we will basically have a complete picture of what's going on when we shake the Fermi liquid with a sudden interaction. And then in the outlook part, I want to tell you something about basically all the questions and possible directions that one can that one can ask once one has kind of specific model, and once one has understood this kind of specific model. So this will lead to a lot of the questions that are actually interesting in our program. Okay, so now a very brief reminder on Fermi liquid theory. So let's just look at electrons. Specifically, we look at non-relativistic electrons, and we put them in a finite box. So we impose some kind of boundary conditions. So the artist's impression here is that we have some electrons. And the interplay of the boundary conditions and the kinetic energy leads to a spectrum that consists of single particle energy levels, which we can fill with, because these are fermions, spin up and spin down electrons up to the number of electrons that we want to, that we have in our system. So this would be n electrons. So we fill this system up to the Fermi energy with electrons. And essentially what we have here is a single particle picture. So we basically can we put in one electron after the other. And apart from the Pauli principle, they don't see each other. And they just, in the ground state, they just fill up the levels starting at the lowest energy level. Now, we can add some static charge background. So this would be, think of the positive ion, positive ions in some solid, and let's assume we have something that is nicely periodic. So then, what one is looking at now is one is looking at the electrons moving in some potential landscape, and because we took this background, we approximated this as being static, which is of course an approximation because we do have lattice vibrations. This will lead to basically a non-trivial band structure. So the only main difference from this picture up here is that now our energy levels will have non-trivial spacing. We can have things like band gaps and so on. But the essential picture remains unchanged. We have a single particle picture and which we fill where we fill the states up to the Fermi energy. So this is what we have here is the Fermi gas. And one can work out all the properties. And one property, for example, is the specific heat, which is linear in temperature with the Sommerfeld coefficient. With the Sommerfeld coefficient, that is pi squared third. And rho f is the density of states at the Fermi energy. OK. So now, the interesting part starts when we add the electron-electron interaction. So that's the Coulomb repulsion. And this immediately turns this single particle problem into a complicated many particle problem. And the key insight by Landau was that we can, in a way, still effectively think of a system with not too strong electron-electron interaction for, with respect to its low-lying excitation, as some effective single particle problem. And so the fundamental assumption, though one can show that this is that one can verify this diagrammatically, is what's called the adiabatic evolution of low-lying states. So what does this mean? So over here, we have the Fermi gas. So this is essentially our non-interacting system. Non-interacting system in the sense that we don't have a two-particle interaction, but only kind of a potential interaction. And liquid is the system with electron-electron interaction. So this is non-interacting. And now the kind of Gedanken experiment by Landau is to switch on this interaction very slowly. It's basically switch on slowly. I can say something about how slow later. I think I heard that question, but this is at the end of the talk. Almost know where these questions are coming from. Well, you get the answer later. Okay, so now, so here, the ground state, we've seen it already. So here we have filled all the levels up to a certain energy. This is the ground state. And now if I switch on the interaction very slowly, we end up in the ground state. And if I look at an excited state, so let's move one of these electrons up. This would be the excited state. Then at an excited state in the interacting system. Now, the statement by Landau is that we can identify these quantum states after this adiabatic procedure, again, as an effective single particle problem. Except that now these particles are not the original electrons, but they are quasi-particles, meaning they have the same statistics. They are still fermions. They are still spin 1/2 particles. However, they have, in general, a different mass than the bare electrons. So this picture of being able to describe the low-lying levels of the interacting system in terms of quasi-particles simplifies dealing with this Fermi liquid tremendously. I mean, for example, if we are interested in studying an excited system, so let's say we have a few excitations here, what we need to look at is only the quasi-particle interaction. Yeah? That is still part of this Fermi liquid description. However, we do not need to take into account that the excited particle also interacts with 10 to the 23 minus 1 particles that are still sitting in the Fermi sea. So that's been taken into account by these energy levels that I'm showing here. What we need to look at is only the remaining quasi-particle interaction. That is a conceptual simplification that we will make use of later. So this quasi-particle picture only becomes exact close to the Fermi energy. In fact, these states here have a finite lifetime that are virtually close to the Fermi energy. The key property that we will need right now is that if we accept this picture, and we can accept it for definitely for in three interactions given certain technical conditions, then we can say that the ground state of the Fermi liquid looks very similar to the ground state of the Fermi gas in the sense that we have all quasi particle levels filled up to the Fermi energy. So if we draw now the momentum distribution function, this just tells you whether states are filled or not. So for the Fermi gas, let's say this is for spin up or spin down electrons, all the states up to the Fermi energy are filled. And so these are the electrons. Now for the Fermi gas, I've just told you that exactly the same thing happens for the quasi particles. And we will use this picture again and again later on. Now, for the actual electrons, this translates into a distribution function which looks like this. So this is the famous momentum distribution function. This is for the physical electrons again, of Fermi liquid at zero temperature. The reason why this discontinuity here of Fermi energy at zero temperature is no longer a jump that's equal to 1, but is a jump that's equal to c smaller than 1, has to do with the fact that if you go from here to here, the overlap between these states is not exactly 1, but is kind of smaller than 1, and this gives rise to this discontinuity, which is no longer 1. This discontinuity of the distribution function at the Fermi energy is key for many of the interesting properties of metals. I mean, in a way, you can say the fact that we have something like BCS superconductivity comes from the fact that we have a discontinuity, at least at sufficiently low temperature. Mm-hmm. One needs some kind of non-analytic feature in the theory to get this kind of instabilities. And once you start washing this out to non-zero temperature, you lose this non-analyticity, and then, for example, you lose lots of the interesting low-temperature phases. So this kind of discontinuity is a trademark, and a very important trademark, of Fermi liquids and... okay. So... Okay, so this is kind of the standard model for our understanding of levels. And now, well, we've said something about the spectrum. And at zero temperature, I told you what the momentum distribution function is like. But now, what do we do at non-zero temperature? So at non-zero temperature, the moment I say non-zero temperature, I immediately imply that I'm actually coupling to some heat bath. So let's look at our solid, which is described by Hamiltonian, and somehow simplified, we can think of it as the electronic subsystem. Then we have lattice degrees of freedom. These are coupled. And then we put the whole thing in a thermostat. And then the thermostat is at some beta. And then what equilibrium statistical mechanics tells us is that we can describe the state of this solid, or if we simplify just of the electronic subsystem, as a density matrix e to the minus beta h. The h is the Hamiltonian of the system that we are interested in. So basically, what we have is we have an incoherent superposition of energy eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, the many-body Hamiltonian, with Boltzmann weights. That's what equilibrium statistical mechanics tells us. And now, so the question that I want to address in this talk is, if we now take Landau's Gedanken experiment, namely this slow switching on of the interaction, and do it in a closed system, so one that is not coupled to an environment. So here we have our Fermi gas, which is now isolated and initially prepared in its zero temperature ground state. And now we switch on the interaction, but we switch it on no longer slowly, but initially we will do it suddenly, and then later I will tell you something about what happens when you do it with some non-trivial rate. So we ask the question, what happens when we basically, when we switch on the interactions, or when we do this Gedanken experiment as an isolated system, but we do it suddenly. Of course, if we do this adiabatically slowly, then we just arrive at the Fermi liquid picture over there. Okay, why would one be interested in doing this? So one reason why one can be interested in doing this is that by following this procedure, we will prepare the system in a state which is not a Gibbs state. So the initial many body state that we have is constructed in a certain way by performing work on the system, but it is or you can say the initial state is actually is a Fermi gas. So this Fermi gas is not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian with interaction. So we are separating two things. We have one Hamiltonian which is responsible for the time evolution of the problem, and we have in a way the Fermi gas which defines us the state that we are actually looking at. So in a way, this gives us more freedom and the possibility to do maybe interesting things with these kind of non-Gibbs things. Another reason is that one can actually do such experiments in cold atomic gases. So that's an experimental development over the past more than one decade now. One can cool atomic gases of bosonic or fermionic atoms to millikelvin temperatures and, for example, confine them on artificial lattices due to counterpropagating lasers. One can manipulate the interaction between these atoms by playing with external fields, that's magnetic fields, for example, by exploiting what's called Feshbach resonances. So in a way, these cold atomic gases are a laboratory where we can model many body systems, and we can play with their interaction or their relative interaction strength in a time-dependent way. This is much harder to do in a real solid. So one can do these things in a time-dependent way, and the coupling to the environment can be so weak that we can think of a setup as this. So this is basically, ideas like this are nowadays experimentally realizable because we have time-dependent control of such interactions. Another motivation is that in the experimental community, there is currently a lot of effort in what's called pump-probe experiments. So this is, I'm drawing the same picture as over there, so this is our solid. These are the electrons. This is the lattice. Of course, I cannot really draw them separately, but simplifying it. And here, we hit the electrons with a laser pulse, the femtosecond laser pulse with very high fluence. Then we excite the electronic subsystem. And because nowadays one can construct laser pulses that live only, that basically that only excite on the femtosecond timescale, this coupling to the lattice typically lives on the order of picoseconds. So one can basically excite these electrons in a highly excited state, and at least for a certain time scale, one can think of this as an isolated system. Okay, and then last but not least, one other reason to be interested in these kind of experiments is that this is basically something related to the foundation of quantum statistical mechanics. And the question is, when we write down this density matrix, do we actually need this coupling to some large bath? This is the usual prerequisite if you want to derive it. Or is it sufficient to say that we have somehow a complicated system that is isolated, and then we do something to it, and then we wait a long enough time, and then we can say, okay, now we can describe this isolated system in this way. So is basically, can a system serve as its own heat bath? This question is rather subtle. I want to come back to it at the very end, because if we start in a pure state, whatever we are going to do, we will end up in a pure state, unitary time evolution. So we cannot come from a pure state to an incoherent mixture of states. So in a way, the question of what one means by the system serving as its own heat bath needs to be elaborated on. Okay, so now, I think I'll continue over there. So now we want to put these things together. So we want to answer this question, and we want to see what happens here. And we switch on the interaction suddenly. And we will be able to basically understand this from a very simple example, which one can actually give your students in a quantum mechanics course. However, I recommend not giving it to them in the exam. I tried that. And I realized that they don't like to learn new things in the exam. I mean, okay, simple example. So this is, so what we are looking at now is, so we want to do such an interaction crunch, but we want to do it in a very simple system, namely in a discrete quantum system. So we have something that just consists of some discrete energy levels. They're not using any thermodynamic limit. And we have the Hamiltonian, where at time t equals 0, we switch on some interaction, and the non-interacting ground state the non-interacting ground state is rho naught, and the interacting ground state is rho naught. So, okay, and now we are interested in an observable that fulfills the following two conditions. It annihilates the non-interacting ground state. Well, I can always achieve that by just subtracting the expectation value in the non-interacting ground state. And it commutes. It commutes with H0. And now one can...
Not the same, right?
Sorry?
The expectation value.
Oh, okay. I'm saying it commutes with this, so I can find a simultaneous eigenbasis, so it's actually sufficient to subtract the ground state expectation value. But of course, yeah. Okay, so now the what one can show in second-order perturbation theory in G is the following. We prepare the system in the ground state of H0. And then, well, at time t equals 0, we start driving the evolution of the full Hamiltonian. And now we measure the observable in the time-evolved state. And we average over this time evolution. So OT is just e to the minus IHTO, e to the IHT. So this is just basically we prepare the system in the ground state. And then we do the quench. And here, of course, you will have all kinds of Rabi oscillations. And we average over all of them. And now you can show very easily that this is simply twice the expectation value of the observable in the interacting ground state plus higher order terms. But this is, by the way, I should say that this is some work that I did together with a former PhD student of mine, Michael Merkel. You can find it in these papers. So this is, the main feature is this factor 2. And this simple factor 2 will be responsible for all the formalization that I'll talk about later. And so for this small result, the one which I consider the highest possible kind of compliment from a Russian colleague, who told me he believes that this one does not exist in Landau Lifshitz. So the jury is still out, I'm not sure, but so far no one has pointed out to me that this one is in Landau Lifshitz. Okay, so instead of going through the...
What happens if each interaction commutes without?
Then basically if H interaction commutes with this, then here of course we have, this is just the initial expectation value, yeah. So this is basically, this is just the initial expectation, omega not O, omega. But then it has to be zero. Then it has to be zero, yeah. Then it has to be zero. And then it will also be zero here. I think the technical requirement is I must assume that the ground state is non-degenerate. I didn't write that down. Non-degenerate initial ground state. Okay. So the example, instead of going through the calculation, I'll just show you the example. We prove by example, and the example is we shift an harmonic oscillator. So we have a harmonic oscillator, and you can also squeeze it, gives the same, gives very similar results. So we shift this thing. And now the observable that we are interested in is just going to be H0 minus the ground state energy. Now, but this is just a number operator. We're just counting the number, it's just a number operator with respect to the original basis. Obviously, it fulfills all requirements. So now what happens here is that, okay, let's draw this here. So this is the potential before the shift, and this is the potential after the shift. This is G. So now the this expectation value down here, well, I'm drawing classical mechanics now. This is the ground state. There's obviously no dynamics you're in the ground state. So I can just read off this expectation value over here. Yeah? So this is the expectation value that is basically indexing. One way of doing this is also to say that, okay, we start here and then we slowly switch on the interaction. So we slowly do this shift and then this ball remains lying at the bottom of the well and then we end up in this situation. Now we do the interaction quench, and what we do now is that we suddenly shift this thing. And if you suddenly shift this thing, the ball remains lying here. Yeah? Now we have Rabi oscillations. I call this Rabi oscillations. So we're moving from here to here. We have kinetic energy. And if we measure the potential energy with respect to the old potential, we go up all the way here. And you put these two things together, and you find exactly this factor 2. Actually, here's an exact result. So here, there's no approximation. There's no approximation involved. Okay, now, this is the simple example, and now we want to put this to use in a non-trivial setup, namely, we want to use this for studying our quench in the Fermi liquid. Okay, so now we do Fermi gas to Fermi liquid, but quickly. So with a quench. Well, so initially our Hamiltonian is just the kinetic energy. And for positive times, we have the kinetic energy plus the electron-electron interaction. And the observable that we'd be interested in, well, that's just going to be the momentum distribution function. Or 1 minus the momentum distribution function below the Fermi energy. Obviously, this fulfills all the conditions of this small theorem that we had before, except for one. Here, we are interested in thermodynamic limit. So this is not a discrete system. And this is, I mean, and that will change something later on. But let's just be naive and apply it in this way. Okay, so what's the conclusion? The conclusion is that when we time average over the distribution function for above states above the Fermi energy, we should find twice the equilibrium value, and below we should find twice the deviation from 1. So the picture that we have is I can draw it over here, yeah. So the picture that we have is the following. So this is the distribution function in equilibrium. And now I've told you that I will have twice the number up here and 1 minus, 2 times 1 minus the number here. So after the quench, I will get something that looks like this. This is the prediction. And in fact, we will later see that this is exactly what's happening. So we end up with a distribution function which has a smaller quasi-particle residue than what it would have in equilibrium. Okay, so one can also study the initial time evolution, not only looking at these time averages. One can see that this builds up over a time scale that's related to the bandwidth, inverse bandwidth of the model. And then within basically what this theorem says, this thing would be stable for all times. Question is this really true? I mean, this is the small theorem is for discrete systems, and we are not looking at a discrete system. And to see what happens on longer timescales, we need to remember what Boltzmann talks. So now we want to address the question, what happens on longer timescales? So then, basically, the his kinetic theory for dilute gases in 1872, he wrote down the following equation for the for a function that had the probabilistic interpretation, namely the density of particles at a point xp is f, can now be time dependent. And he wrote down the kinetic equation here for without any external forces. So this is just the streaming term. And then on the right-hand side, have the famous collision term. And if I'm looking at the case of elastic two-particle collisions, I mean, this collision term is, well, it's basically as a it has a structure. So here we have a matrix element that tells us something about scattering processes, probability of scattering processes. Then it's elastic, so the energies before and after the collision must be identical. Then momentum is conserved. And then, well, the key feature is that we have two processes. We have a gain term and a loss term. So a gain term tells us we have two gas molecules with momenta p3 and p4, and they scatter, and afterwards I have momenta p and p2. So basically, this is the gain term, and this is the process that's described by W. So, and the probability for doing this process is just that the probability of finding these two particles initially at momenta p3 and p4. And then we also have a loss term, and the loss term is p and p2 scattered to p3 and p4. So, so this is so one very attractive feature of this equation is that if we look at the isotropic case, so we forget the x dependence. One can easily generalize it, but I keep it simple. For the isotropic case, at least for a physicist, this equation has only one fixed point, and that's a Maxwell distribution. Whatever you throw at it initially, you end up with a Maxwell distribution. It is the only fixed point. This is a Maxwell distribution. And how do you prove this? The proof is basically the H theorem, which tells you that the entropy, which is just minus the integral over f log f, can only increase under time evolution. And then you find the only possibility where this does not increase anymore is where this where you have the Maxwell distribution. So the question that people have been asking since Boltzmann wrote down this equation is, where does actually irreversibility enter in this equation? I mean, this thing here is, you can, well, we assume microscopic reversibility here, so this process and this, but basically you can exchange P3, P4, and PP2, you have the same matrix element. So where does the irreversibility enter? Well, there's a number of different ways of looking at this, but essentially, what one is assuming here is that the two particles are uncorrelated before the collision. And of course, we know that the collisions are then going to produce correlations. But we always work with the assumption that pre-collision, we have uncorrelated particles. So the breaking of the reversibility actually happens in this assumption about the probability distribution. And so that's why for dilute gases, if you assume that, you know, two particles don't meet again, this might be a good assumption. Yep.
So does Maxwell distribution know about interactions?
No. You just have to assume, you know, sufficiently generic interaction, and then you end up in this thing.
We're all sufficiently weak somehow when all these works.
No, you don't need to do that. It's a neat little proof, this thing here. I mean, basically you have a function that only increases as a function of time, and you look at its fixed point. So this is basically where the irreversibility enters, and one can prove that this is actually true under certain conditions mathematically. I mean, there's a lot of work that's been done by especially Langford, who shows that this can actually, in certain cases, in certain limits, be made mathematically rigorous. So now this is what we want to apply now. Here, and we have one obvious drawback, and that is that we are looking at a quantum system and not at a classical system. So we need to generalize, or let's just say, apply this to a quantum system. And so what we have now is we want to look at a quantum kinetic equation. And the only thing that we are actually going to change is that we introduce the quantum statistics in the gain and loss term. In the gain and loss term.
Yeah,
sure.
Is the result perturbative also?
This small theorem is perturbative. So this is perturbative in the interaction. I will show one slide later where you will see that it actually holds compared with numerical simulations up to surprisingly large interactions.
So it's not really
that.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is that, I mean, this theorem holds for discrete systems. We are looking at the dynamic limit now, so we don't really expect this to be true for all times, except later you will see that for integrable systems it is true for all times, but in general it won't be true. Okay, so the only thing that we are doing now is that we introduce basically quantum statistics, so this gain loss term from over there is generalized by Fermi statistics and P. So we can only scatter in a state that is empty. And we can only scatter out of a state. But obviously if it's full, if we scatter into a state that is empty. This is the only thing that we've done. And if we just take this, then again, we have the very nice feature that the only fixed point of the time evolution is the Fermi-Dirac distribution, whatever you do. Now, in order to derive this equation, to the best of my knowledge, there's no mathematically exact results. One very important feature here is that this distribution function here refers to quasi-particles. Yeah? The kinetic equation is an equation for quasi-particles, not for the physical not for the initial electrons. Yeah? So the next thing that one can ask is the question, okay, here I'm writing down x and p simultaneously. How can I justify this in this equation? One needs to look at the corresponding scaling limits, etc. But so for now, the main observation is that this is an equation that we believe to be true for quasi-particles. If it is true for quasi-particles, then I can come back to this picture here. So before, I've told you that after this initial quench, after some time evolution, I will end up with a distribution function for my electrons that looks like this. So I know that this here corresponded to this zero temperature quasi-particle distribution, which is a fixed point of the quantum kinetic equation. So now if I ask, what does this correspond to for my quasi-particles? Well, it corresponds to something like this, which is not a fixed point. So this is going to evolve under the quantum kinetic equation. So what one has produced here is basically, in this initial dynamics, one produces something which is, in a way, a non-thermal distribution function of the quasi-particles after the quench. And then what happens after the what happens if one basically looks at the Boltzmann equation is that these quasi-particles are going to see that they have phase space available for scattering, and this distribution function is going to thermalize. So the kinetic equation will tell us that we end up with a Fermi-Dirac distribution with some temperature that is larger than zero because of the quasi-particle interaction. And so if I draw a picture, I can ask, how does the discontinuity at the Fermi energy develop as a function of time? So initially, I start at 1, that's my Fermi gas. Then this would be the value in equilibrium for the interacting theory. So I go down here. This is some initial dynamics. This is basically, you can say this is the formation of the quasi-particles. The electrons become pressed by electron hole pairs. Then this is a regime which we have called pre-thermalized, in the sense that if you look at the total kinetic energy or the total interaction energy, it's time invariant, it doesn't change anymore. However, if you look into the momentum distribution function in a, basically, then you see that this energy is distributed non-thermally over the various modes. And then on longer time scales, you have something that is basically driven by the kinetic equation and thermalizes the system.
And what is the parameter that controls this operation of scales?
That's the interaction strength. So this is 1 over the bandwidth.
So it's only for
weak interaction. I'll show a slide now, yes. So this is 1 over the bandwidth. This is 1 over the coupling constant squared, and it's thermalized 1 over the coupling constant 4. So you can separate it very far if you make the interaction.
At small interaction,
yes. Okay, so this is picture that we get, and I mean, the one thing that I like about it is you see that everything here is due to this factor of 2. You know, if we ended up over here, there would be nothing happening over here. Okay, so now I want to show one slide, which basically to demonstrate that this is what one also finds if one does numerics. Okay, it's coming already. Okay. Okay, so so this is now work done by Eckstein, Koller, and Philipp Werner, And so this is basically a numerically exact method. This is quantum Monte Carlo done for this model in a specific limit, in the limit of high spatial dimensions. That's this dynamical mean field limit. And this is basically the set of key that I plotted before. These dashed lines here, that's exactly basically the result that you expect based on this factor 2 prediction. Yeah? Basically, the equilibrium value would be half here if you look at this value. And you can see this is the initial formation of quasar particles. Then one kind of gets stuck here at this value, and then something else happens on longer timescales. So one can actually, one can see this picture, and one can also see that one has a very nice separation. I mean, for the small value of u, you can't even drive the numerics long enough so that you can see the kinetic equation at the end.
Stefan, can yeah. U, it's units of Fermi energy?
Yeah, it's some units of Fermi energy plus some factors that I don't recall. So, and then over here, one can also analytically calculate the short time dynamics, and I mean, it works pretty well. I mean, these predictions work for surprisingly large values of the interaction, actually. Okay, so.
Just to be sure, so once you're off the pre-thermalization plateau, the sharpness of the step is smeared.
Whether the step is really a sharp step, I mean, the way I'm drawing it here, or whether it is, smeared out on some small energy scale, that I actually cannot say.
But in your calculation,
it's a sharp step, yes.
But then the kinetic equation predicts that then it just sort of thermalizes fully.
Yes.
Smooth.
Yeah,
but smooth. What you're saying is that in higher order perturbation theory somehow that step there may be another.
I mean, from my point of view, it always looks like a step, but I wouldn't dare to make a statement about this in all orders of perturbation theory. Not really. Order?
This is DMFT, so it has no k dependence other than the one coming from the dispersion. So in this sense, the u cannot really do anything to the k dependence of the dispersion either.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, the stuff that I showed you can do with arbitrary dispersion relation. I mean, so yeah. Okay. So these are the two slides that I wanted to show. Kind of one question that was semi-quietly asked before, how slow is slow? You can also study the crossover. If you switch on the interaction over some time scale tau, you can do this calculation as well for linear ramp. And what you find is that for this linear ramp, the temperature that you get at the end scales as 1 over the ramping time over which you switch off the interaction. So you can see that if you do it slower and slower, you arrive at a Fermi liquid with lower and lower temperature. A side remark, however, the momentum distribution function at the Fermi energy itself does uniformly approach the zero temperature limit. Okay, that's a remark for the specialists. Never mind. Okay, so this is now. I want to end with some outlook. So, and kind of obvious questions that one can ask once one has gone through this fairly simple story here. What I have chosen to look at very specific observables in this model.
I mean, this is for tau much larger than g? Or?
Yes, this is for tau much larger than some factor g times the density of states. Yeah, exactly. Otherwise, of course, this becomes proportional to G times the density of states for short times. That's the work, effectively the work that you're performing if you do the crunch. You can figure out how much work are you performing, and then you can see that for small interaction crunches, the work that you're performing gets completely converted into this effective temperature.
And what happens if you have the Lackinger liquid in 1D?
So
it should be completely different because
it's completely different. This is a perturbative calculation, exactly, and it doesn't work in 1D. It breaks down immediately.
Because there's no
generalization. Exactly, and it doesn't. I'll come to this now. So no, this calculation requires perturbation theory. If perturbation theory fails, I can't do anything. Okay, so some questions that one can ask is, okay, if one is interested in this kind of formalization, what are actually the observables that one should look at? I've chosen very specific observables. But does one expect, if I find this behavior in a certain number of observables, is it clear that I find it in all observables? Then, what happens in one dimension? Yeah? And what's the role of integrability? Well, the reason for asking this is, if you remember the Boltzmann equation that I wrote down before, the assumption was, this kind of simplified picture, we had energy conservation and momentum conservation. In 1D, if we have a nonlinear dispersion relation, that doesn't work for two particle scattering process. So essentially, it means that if you look at the looking at liquid, you're stuck here. You're always in this. Basically, you have some initial dynamics, and you can see this, and then you basically you can view it in this way that you're basically stuck in this state, because you have no scattering processes that remain that thermalize your system.
I think it is not only integrability, because if you take Kolodner Sandler model with the parabolic spectrum, I think you will still have some thermalization despite integrability. Is that true? My intuition is based on these works by Kamenev and Glasman about the inelastic processes and the role of course, the conservation law and first of all, parabolicity. And if you have just Lackinger liquid, you don't have. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. I think I need to look at this model. Maybe we can discuss it later. Yeah. Yeah. I think one observation is clear. You can see why one-dimensional systems are more complicated from this point of view, because the quantum kinetic equation is not going to be as effective. Generically, you need at least three particle scattering processes to allow to fulfill all conditions. If you have an integrable system, then even these won't be possible. This shows you why integrable systems and one-dimensional systems are similar here, but this part is missing. How do we describe the initial dynamics or this pre-thermalized state? You want to call it like this. How do we describe this regime of time evolution where we cannot apply a quantum kinetic equation because we don't have well-defined quasi particles at this point? Okay. Now, what do we do in systems where we don't have well-defined quasi particles? You can have close to non-trivial quantum phase transitions, then obviously this whole approach here is not going to work in this way. Then there is another topic that came up in our program, and that's the topic of many-body localization. And there are some results on this by Pal and Hughes, and then by Wosk and Ehud Altman. Also, we have a talk about this in the conference, that for certain disordered quantum spin chains, you can show that these systems actually do not serve as their own heat bath. So you can see that they do remember the initial conditions. But this was related to this one question before, whether you can always assume that basically you can describe the system as e to the minus beta h if you wait long enough. And there are systems where, there is compelling evidence that this is not true. But these are disordered systems. And so this is some questions that are related to this topic of stabilization. And then the last 2 minutes, I want to make a remark about these non-Gibbs states. I mean, my personal opinion is that, subjective, that actually maybe in the future, even more interesting than these conceptual questions of thermalization, the question what one can basically do with such non-Gibbs states. I mean, here we have produced something that is, well, unusual, but it's not really a very interesting state. But I mean, there are many possible non-Gibbs states that one can produce. There is a quote attributed to von Neumann. I'm not sure if it's really true, but it's attributed to him, which is saying that the theory of non-equilibrium is like the theory of non-elephants. And there are, I mean, many non-elephants in the quantum antiparticle zoo, many non-Gibbs states in the quantum antiparticle zoo. So I hope that some of them will turn out to be interesting. Make no mistake, when you, the Gibbs states are very important. If you couple to an environment, the elephant is going to win if you wait long enough. But nowadays we are able to do experiments in a controlled way where we can, at least for interesting timescale, look at isolated quantum many-body systems or excite systems on so short timescales that we can, again, over a certain time window, ignore the coupling to other degrees of freedom. So one has, I mean, some possibility to look at such states and to ask if they have interesting, properties. And there are some, I mean, I think the best known example, of course, from non-equilibrium statistical mechanics, if you look at the interplay of driving and dissipation, you have all kinds of interesting phenomena like pattern formation and so on. With respect to these pump probe experiments that I showed you before, I mean, there are experiments that are interpreted in the following way, from the group of Andrea Cavalieri, that you have systems which have competing kinds of order. In this case, this compounded stripe order and superconductivity. And by pumping the system, you kill the stripe order and you get the superconductivity. So this, I think the jury is still out on these kind of experiments, on these kind of ideas. But I believe that there is there are interesting things to look at along this line, and not only when it comes to the question of thermalization. Okay, I think my time is up. Thank you.
So my intuition would have been that the non-Gibbs states would predominantly be classical.
Sorry.
Would predominantly be the classical physics, even if the underlying system is quantum mechanical. And I don't see how they wouldn't be described generically by time Jenkins of Landau theory with non-Hamiltonian dynamics.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me one of the interesting questions is when, if ever, do the does quantum mechanics matter in these long-time non-equilibrium situations? I guess in this many body localization is one example.
That's definitely one example. Yeah, it's definitely
there are others.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree with that. I certainly agree with that. Yeah.
Excellent.